exercise that would be not very correct. The organization out here would want to respond first, because they are the ones that who indicated that they want to leave. Their flights are at 3 o'clock. Could you please, past three or so, but they want to leave by 2 here, so that they get to their flights. All of us know why all of us know how Ilendo traffic in Cape Town is, and I think it is not our last time to interact with them. We will keep on sucking information out of them every now and again when the needs arise. So it's not going to be the last time that we meet them. Yeah. Agreed?
Yes.
Okay. All right. For the sake of time for them, there will be no follow-up. Okay. You'll write your follow-up question and you'll reserve it for some other time. I will give over to you the representative from out to respond to questions. I also ask members, I would also wish that as much as we need information, they, because they are in a rush, let us not expect them to detail everything. Yes. Okay. I just want them to be free. Okay.
Chair,
thank you very much.
Chair. They might want to supplement in writing as well if you want.
Well, for sure. I don't want to commit myself to that one. But I'll give over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, honourable members, and thanks for the indulgence to let us leave early. I'm quickly going to respond on certain of the questions, and as requested, we will, wherever there's any uncertainty surrounding our presentation, all the answers, we will submit answers in writing to this committee. There was a few questions regarding the statements that after you are laying the charges, criminal charges against certain individuals, what's the follow-up? What are you going to do? I can assure the members of this committee, as well as everybody else interested, that in the past we have laid charges against persons like Gladys Mucheneng, like the BNP CEO regarding the SAA matter, and we are following it up. We putting pressure on the investigating officers. We have got a system where we phone them and go and see them as much as possible, at least every 3 to 4 weeks, once a month. So it is to follow up. I think we are putting pressure on the investigation officers so that this thing does not get cold, all these cases. I can report back that on the BNP matter, the SAA matter, the investigation is in a very advanced stage, and we are at this stage talking to the prosecutor. So there is movement, and we undertake to follow up on all matters that they charge us. One thing that I want to put out to you regarding that is quickly that we were also tasked by the SIU to assist in the SABC investigation. And I think it is important there for members of parliament to also put their voices to the actions that must take place. Everything there is ready. We've been talked with the SIU, and still we are waiting for a proclamation that they can carry on with their investigation. I'm going to leave that there, but I think it is important for members of parliament also to put the pressure on where needed. Quickly, there was a question regarding the recruitment strategies of people in government and in the SOEs, how does it work? How do they get recruited to do these acts? I want to take you back to a speech that was made here in Parliament on the 1st of November 2011, 1-1-11-2011, by Minister Gigaba when he put down the and announced the medium-term plan for the Department of Public Enterprises. Have a look at the introduction there, as reported by the Parliamentary Monitoring Group. It looks like a shopping list. If you look at that...
Oh, the date is the 1st of November 2011.
Yes, that's correct. 1st November 2011. If you look at the announcement made there and the medium-term plans for the Department of Public Enterprises, and you see a few years down the line what happened, is that I think that everybody will be able to recognize the shopping list, as we call it at our time. I'm not going to elaborate on that, but please do have a look at that. Lastly, I think Honorable Gordon asked the question, what's our message to the public out there? Our message is clear and it's simple. Keep on fighting and be brave. We don't want the whistleblowers to not come to the fore. We want the whistleblowers to come and speak to us. We've got a lot of information. We received a lot of information from whistleblowers, from members of the public, from people that work for these state-owned entities, for government, for the public service. If you're a public servant, serve the public, be brave, come forward, and do not let this continue or ever happen again in our country. Thank you, Honourable Members.
Thank you. No addition, Mr. Bloom.
Madam Chair, if I may continue where my colleague has left off, I'm going to briefly put my answer into 4 points, and the rest we'll do in writing after today. I've been involved with Eskom since 1988, either inside, alongside, on top or underneath, whichever way suited the moment. In terms of when any inquiry needs to start, I am of the firm view, and I've said so a number of times before, that the rot started when Eskom was converted to a commercialized organization in 2001, with the Eskom Commercialization Act. The environment under which Eskom started operating had changed, but the management seemed to have been oblivious to that. So I would urge that any investigation starts in 2001. There's a board resolution, which is of particular importance relating to that year. In terms of the further questions as to what are these professional bodies, consultants, lawyers, auditors, etc., etc., and other hangers-on at Eskom, what are they doing there? Now, all I can say is I don't think they're doing their job. I'm aware, it's not just at Eskom, but at other entities as well, that auditors hold on for dear life. So the rotation of auditors is paramount, of paramount importance. Because they hold on for dear life, they become beholden to the client, and then they shut their eyes when their eyes should be open. And that goes for the auditors, all the auditing firms. I'm aware of each one of them having transgressed what I would consider good practice. It holds for the law firms as well. They think they're competing with each other, but they've been used, they've been played off one against the other by the perpetrators of all these crimes. As far as the independent and international organizations are concerned, Madam, all I can say is when I was at Eskom in the 2006 to 2008 period, one of the major international firms whose name has been bandied around here was earning $16 million a quarter. And I think they've been doing that nonstop since those days. And they're charging a clerk, or a clerk as they call them in America, to South Africa at over $400 an hour. It's an unheard of tariff. And it's just been going on and on and on nonstop, as far as I'm aware, for at least the last 10 years. And that one particular firm is not the only perpetrator. There are quite a few other hangers-on as well. And if the committee wants me to name and shame them, I'm quite prepared to do that in a written document. As far as the former Minister of Finance's question is concerned, what is the impact of this? Well, I've had discussions over the years with, amongst others, people from Econometrics and other economists, Mike Schussler, etc. And it's our candid assessment that this steering of growth from South Africa has damaged our economy by the tune of 3 to 5% a year for the last 10 years. That's the amount of jobs and muted growth that has arisen because of Eskom's excessive price increases as well as excessive borrowing. Because they, as I said, they had a dual angle. They took money from us and they took money from overseas, and we're going to have to pay that back sometime either. So I think the impact, the negative impact of Eskom's behavior over the last 10 years or 12 years has cost us between 3 and 5% in growth and in jobs. And lastly, this might come as a shock, I hope everybody's sitting down. I have evidence, and I say so very candidly, that the load shedding of 2008 and the load shedding around 2014 was self-inflicted by Eskom. And it is also part of the corrupt practices. The 2008 one, I can give you the full details of how Eskom was held hostage by some of the coal producers, and in terms of 2010 to 2014, how more than 10 billion a year in maintenance disappeared and was never done at Eskom. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I think you responded very well, and your response being noted. But as we have already said, that we are not going, it's not our last interaction with you. We will keep on interacting with you. Thank you very much for your presentation and your responses.
Thank you, Chair.
Oh, you don't forget those that you are going to send in writing, right? Yeah.
No, and thank you very much, Chair, and the honourable members, and good luck with the investigation and with the inquiry further. Thank you.
We need that. Thank you very much. You are humbly released by this committee. Thank you very much. Till we meet again. I will now give over to the South African Council of Churches to respond. Who? The professor? All of you will respond. Oh, you want the response? The professor to respond, if any. Thank you. Professor, the SACC is giving over to you to respond to questions that you think they need your attention.
Thank you very much for the questions. So let me return to the sort of the broad thesis which we've made, of which I think that what you're seeing in Eskom is just an example. The argument essentially, and I'll come to the Honourable Mania's question in a moment, is that a political project comes to turn against the Constitution and the law, and it creates a general environment and a general context where illegality, criminality, and non-compliance with government processes and regulations becomes permissible and tolerable. So what it does is create a general environment where all sorts of shenanigans become possible. Some of the motives for non-compliance or breaking the rules are in good faith in pursuit of a particular project. Some are criminal. We can't reduce it simply to criminality. So there may be other motives going on as well. So it's in this context, we argue, that we have to understand the goings on at Eskom with regard to coal contracts, etc. So the argument essentially is that a general environment produces a space for criminalization. So I think if we understand this as having underpinned by a political conviction, I think we can begin to understand the brazenness of some of these operations. I think we have to come to terms with the sense that there is a righteousness in some of these actions, a sense of righteousness. that these are people operating on the basis not simply of a self-serving agenda, but a sense that they're in pursuit of a higher cause. Honourable Gordon, I showed you, for example, a clip of a speech by Brian Malef on the January the 8th, where he's making that point very, very clearly, that he's a deployee. Sometimes he's asked to do things which he doesn't understand why, but when in later life, when he's explained the bigger picture, he'll come to realize that what he was doing was in the service of the organization. I really do think we have to come to terms that there is a political conviction at work here, which is why we have to be careful not to reduce every instance of criminality to the same story. So, Honourable Mania, your question around, yes, there are events and moments that have happened prior to Polokwane, which suggest of a longer-term pattern. Don't forget there was the arms deal. But I would ask you to distinguish between various moments. You haven't forgotten, I understand that. I mean, don't forget in the sense of reducing these all to the same phenomenon. So there is a concept which we use in the report, which I think is a very potent political concept. We know we've developed this notion of repurposing institutions. So I think one might understand the events around Chancellor House, for example, in relationship to not simply of criminality, but in relationship to party political funding, which is an issue which I think is which I would beg this committee to probe in relationship to some of the ESCOM deals. I don't think it's just a process of self-enrichment. I think there are lots of sort of paybacks going to political parties, but also to factions of political parties to wage political battles. So I think the Chancellor House issue is partly related to party political funding. The repurposing of institutions that we're talking about here is taking over an entire institution and turning it away from its official mandate in the service of an altogether different political project. So I think this is the sense in which this is different to what has happened in the past. How do we correct this? So I think absolutely right. I think where there is evidence of criminality, one has to act against that. Although I think given what we've understood from what's happening in the criminal justice system, I think that route is a limited route, partly because investigations don't proceed or prosecutions don't proceed. So the argument which we would make is that what actions of against particular individuals needs to be accompanied by a generalized reaffirmation of the rule of law, of the importance of and commitment to our constitution and to deepening South African democracy. Again, right, if I remind you, it's our sense of the weakening of that commitment that creates this general space. So going forward, that would be one of the answers. What implications for state capability? I mean, I think this is one of the great dramas. Never mind the looting, never mind the theft of money. I think one of the great, great tragedies of the current moment is the profound, profound weakening of state institutions that we're seeing both at national level but also provincial level. This growing space of illegality, of non-compliance, of criminality is not just happening in national departments and in the institutions I've referred to. It's a generalized atmosphere which is taking a place across the state. So I think it's undoubtedly weakening, and the work that I do at the Public Affairs Research Institute, this is the lion's share of our work, is studying state administrations and how they're performing, and we're seeing undoubtedly a generalized decline of the ability of state institutions to perform on their mandates. I would argue that the way forward in that regard, though, is, yes, protecting public servants, but I think there is an important conceptual and political shift that we have to make as well. Currently, we do not recognize the administrative autonomy of state administrations. There's been a deliberate, understandable, I think, in the early days of the transition, but a deliberate, nonetheless, attempt to politicize administrations in the post-apartheid context. It means that political considerations are overriding all sorts of professional considerations in the appointment of personnel and then the kinds of operations which are undertaken. I think the way forward, and what we can hopefully learn from the ESCOM case, but going forward more generally, is a recommitment to the autonomy and professionalism of public servants, to respect their professionalism, to think about recruitment practices which reduce political discretion, especially of the president, to reinforce and establish professional routes into the public service, like, for example, potentially a universal entrance exam, especially for the senior management service, for advance in the public service on the basis of grading and on the basis of exams. So I think a route to professionalize the public service, but at the same time, and I think more importantly even, is to recognize and to insist on the administrative autonomy of administrations in relationship to the political class. So I think that those are the broad answers. I think in relationship to the report's discussion of middlemen and brokers, your Honourable Gordon, you'll forgive me if I defer to Honourable Shivambu, who I think provided a very good description of how broker systems are working within the state in line with our report. There is a general point that we wanted to make, though, in using this notion of brokers, etc. It's associated with a sense of needing to control an environment which has shifted towards illegality, where you can no longer rely on the discipline of state institutions to control looting and rent and rent-seeking practices. So the argument is that essentially what the shadow state refers to is the establishment of all sorts of informal networks and processes to manage rent-seeking and rent practices. They don't want uncontrollable rent-seeking or uncontrollable corruption. They want the corruption and the rent-seeking to happen through particular routes to benefit particular individuals. In a space of illegality, of course, the risk is that this just spirals completely out of control. So that system of brokers and patrons, as our argument, is a one way of us attempting to argue as to how they might be putting in place some of their own systems of balances and checks within the framework of illegality. I think there have been several other important issues that have been raised. I want to end on the last one, and that is the relationship of private corporations and professional and all sorts of professionals in relationship to the current situation. This is not simply an example of public servants and a political class that is pursuing its perverse purposes. What we're finding is the complicity of all sorts of businesses and professional associations, auditing firms, lawyers, accountants, that are doing the everyday work of putting in place the systems and processes which allow the circulation of money out the country, all sorts of illegal processes are happening with the complicity of professional associations and professional bodies. I think it would be very, very important, an area for this committee to explore. But I also think coming out of this process would be a process for the private sector to increasingly start disciplining itself and disciplining those companies and those associations that are complicit in illegality and criminality. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Professor, thank you very much for your response. And if you think there are other issues, outstanding issues that you think the committee must put their attention to, you are more than welcome to write to us as a committee. And also, we will also interact with you with other issues that you think they are more relevant to you.
On behalf of the state, on the State Capacity Research Group, we would be very, very pleased to offer assistance to this committee. And thank you very much for giving us an opportunity to present our work and to answer your questions. I think this is a very important process. Thank you again.
Thank you very much. Council of Churches, I will give over to you.
Thank you.
Bishop.
I will just close with a benediction. Thank you very much. It certainly was a longer day than I anticipated, and I'm grateful for this opportunity. And I think members would be aware that the SACC Triennial Conference expressed a total loss of hope for the health of the of Parliament, and prevailed on the leadership of the SACC to approach the leadership of Parliament to persuade them to vote themselves into dissolution. If this effort is a response to that call, we would be indeed filled with hope. But I want to say that in response to the question that's been raised about whether we can still reverse the rot in our environment, I must confess that I've had sleepless nights over that myself. And that's partly because I've been the person that's listened most to the hopelessness that people feel across the country over what's going on. And what seems to be happening is that when things happen at the higher level, at the national level, at the leadership level, they have a way of setting the pattern of culture at the lower levels. And because nobody actually follows to see where that culture is percolating, you're not able to reverse it, even if you can sit in a chamber of leaders of the country such as you have here, or of a political party and say, let's change the direction. You're no longer able to go back to the people that you incipiently influenced in a different direction. And what we are getting from our congregations, and by the way, this is part of the reason why we are aggressively moving into what we call a word-based ecumenical ministry to try and arrest the rot in our communities, because it has become rampant, where people don't even see the need to bother about education, because you can always make money. And that is the reason why councillors and candidates for councillors are getting killed, because there's money on the ground. There's money that comes in inappropriate ways, and it has become sort of commonplace. I wouldn't like to confine it to the political and governmental environment. I think that there is a much broader decline of moral values. We're talking today about public ethics, but generally speaking, there is a broader issue. And part of it has to do with, you know, the work that the SSS has been doing is a campaign we call the South Africa We Pray For. It has got various pieces outside of the governance. This is actually five pillars. One is healing and reconciliation that deals with issues of South African identity and all these issues of racism, tribalism. Are we going to forever become 100% Venda, 100% Xhosa, 100% Afrikaner in Oranje? Or are we going to become a South African society? What is it going to take to get there? It's very rare today to hear people talk about a non-racial society. And so it does mean that we have reversed a lot of what we thought were the goals of a common society. We often hear a lot about things being, ANC members like to say, this is un-ANC. We're not hearing much about what is un-South African. What is it that we can all agree on that, you know, if you do this, everyone will say, how? You don't do this as a South African. We don't have much of that. And so therefore, the issue of healing and reconciliation, we're a wounded society, so all of us are in each other's throats, and we believe something has to be done to reverse that. And that has an impact, therefore, on the social values. We're dealing with issues of family collapse. Because we use the model of See, Judge, Act, the C is always the research. We're in partnership with the Human Sciences Research Council that has enabled us to know that, on average, only 38% of South African families have got both parents, 38%. That means a whopping 62% is single parent or child-headed. Now, and if it's a single parent who had worked double hard to put food on the table, there is no time to be transferring values from your previous parents. So that then has an impact. A lot of those parents don't even know if my child does go to school, because I have to leave very early before school starts and I come back after school has ended. And so all of these things have an impact on public values and on social values, at least in our society. So you need to look at it much more holistically, you know, than just what we're dealing with here. And then, of course, we've got the issue of poverty and inequality. I mean, you know, churches will always say, do you believe that poor people are more sinful than rich people? Just because the survival mechanisms for them tend to be outside of the law, that does mean that we have to be realistic about all of these things. So to deal with issues of poverty and inequality is to deal with social values in society. And that's why economic transformation has to happen. It cannot be that the bulk of black people in South Africa will only be consumers and laborers in the economy forever. And that just has to be dealt with. And so we have to make a total commitment, all of us, to these things. And then, of course, we come to the issues of public values, because if you don't have a good government, you can't resolve these other things either. And so all of these things are a package that goes together. And for us, I have to say, speaking for the Sovereign Council of Churches, we came to the conclusion that the governmental environment has really developed the kind of rot that would be very difficult to reverse. And we were very discouraged by what appears to be parliamentary complicit to what government is doing. So instead of being overseers of government, parliament actually becomes collaborators and covers up on what government wrongdoing. And that led us to a view that says, I mean, I can understand a politician in the executive covering their backs, but the politicians in the assembly don't represent themselves, they represent us. And so when they cover up individuals out there, they're actually failing all of us. And that was actually the logic of the National Assembly of the Council of Churches to say, maybe we need a fresh start with everyone. Now, I'm not going to take too much of your time, but just to say that we hope that the ideas that will come from all angles, including from this portfolio committee, must feed into a common conversation by all of us, because it is not the isolated case of this portfolio committee. Every portfolio committee has an issue to deal with. And in fact, outside of the assembly, all of us have issues to deal with. And for this reason, we have called for a national convention, the process of which begins with a lot of working groups that are going to begin from the end of August. And we are hoping to invite political parties to come to the first session of that convention, because the kinds of things that you're suggesting, Professor, now are actually part of that agenda. We have a whole set of former public servants that actually know what the problems are, that have been part of, some of them have left because of these problems, that are participating in the crafting of the issues that make a solution. So what we're really saying is that all of us need to think creatively, positively, and be willing to change the things that otherwise the country is going to go to rot. Are we losing economically? Yes, we are. I can't say how much by how much. It's very difficult. I'm not an econometrist, but I can say that those who know have told us that already in the arms deal corruption, we probably lost something like 1 million jobs, by way of loss of confidence, loss of opportunities. And every time there is a turbulence in the economy, there is a loss. I mean, I can't say that all the current losses in the mining sector are innocent. They're not affected by the current turbulence that we're having at this moment. But we can see a hemorrhaging of jobs in the mining sector at this time, and we don't know why that is happening. And of course, that's going to happen in other sectors as well. We've been talking about industrializing. We cannot industrialize in an economy that is declining. And so all of these things have an impact. And what we're saying is that we need to have our minds in the right place about the future. And for us, it is public ethics. Question has been asked about what we're doing, about what we've heard. You asked that question, Sam. I need to remind you that we started out on a pastoral listening, if you like, on a confessional basis. Now, I can say this great confidence, because in the 80s, we did exactly the same thing with necklaces. We spent time listening to victims, families that whose people had been necklaced, and spent time with people that were perpetrators of these, who had committed, who were part of the crowds that did this. And it was a very traumatic experience, even for the pastors. And so when people are talking to you at that level, your job as a pastor is to be the pastor and try to rehabilitate the people. The individuals that have spoken to us are so afraid for their lives. They say, please, you can't even mention as an example, because they will know it's me, especially in the small towns. Everybody knows who that is once you start talking about the case. And people are dying. People are dying. I mean, right now we've got people that are talking to us who are no longer living in their homes. Others' lives, their lives have been attempted. And, you know, so it's a very sensitive area. It's not the sort of thing that's a law and order environment. It is actually a very sensitive pastoral environment. We would like to believe that South Africa can change for the better. We never thought we'd get back to the days of the 80s in democratic South Africa.
Madam Chair, honorable members, I just want to make a few comments. One, I believe that the one thing that makes a difference is that you need people that are willing to take the necessary risks. When the whole stream flows in one direction, some people must say, we will not go along. And we have seen that. We have seen that in our society. In fact, I think our collapse would have been far greater but for those individuals that stood up. Now, why I'm saying this, Madam Chair, is that this particular commission is part of the structure of our governance. Do we have the kind of possibility in this commission and authority to push this matter to the point where we really start to shift things, because that is what we need? We cannot have a mere recounting of our issues, of our challenges, and a list of what are the problems, and not clarify and identify what needs to be done. And that has been asked now for many times. Now, Madam Chair, I think maybe this thing has gone so far that we cannot stop it anymore. That danger is really there with us at that point. I think this criminality that is being created opens the door for even worse expressions of deviance, of criminality in society. And if the SSCC's report uses the term we are drifting towards a mafia state, if we reach that point, our society will begin to collapse. So, Madam Chair, I'm not sure that the Commission members and all of us really realize at what critical point we are. And if we don't act at the time when we can, we will slip down that slope. Let me just say, Madam Chair, it has been asked constantly, what can be done? What must we do? Firstly, I think we must make it very clear that the facts at our disposal are by far enough to show that we are talking about a deformed situation here. We cannot try to rationalize it in any way. And people tend to do that all the time, especially from political side. We need to say, no, this thing has gone too far, and the facts, let them speak for themselves. Secondly, Madam Chair, it's very important that we be absolutely transparent, that we bring the facts to the public so that we educate our society. Ultimately, you can only stand up if you open up the facts and the information so that everyone can judge for themselves. Our problem in political systems is that we tend to cover up as far as we can, but we need to open up. Our task as a church is in the very first instance to say to our society, these are the troubles that we are suffering. And we must begin to see it for what it is. It's not a racial thing in South Africa anymore. It's in many ways a class thing, because we have 50% of our people without jobs, and people struggling merely to survive. And those people need to have our attention. Then, Madam Chair, the question was asked, what will be our message to our society? The SSCC, I believe, if I draw on our reports in our last General Assembly, the SACC will say it is time that we recognize the real contribution of every true citizen of this country, that we affirm it, that we move beyond a situation where we disqualify a person simply because he's white or whatever, because we have more than enough people with integrity in the society to actually build it up to a very high level, but we are not employing and using those gifts that we have. And so, Madam Chair, when we move towards a more inclusive approach for everyone, we will find that new opportunities will arise. I want to end up by saying, this is now a theological point, Madam Chair, but it's very, very fundamental and basic to our Christian tradition, is that if you do not put those that are the worst off first, if you do not elevate the people on the margins first, that is your rule that guides you in everything. Now, in South Africa, it has not been done. Maybe at the beginning of our transition, today it is completely lost. Because the people out there in the townships, they are completely forgotten, unless they start to burn something.
Thank you very much. Reverend Grove, we said we are not going to have follow-up questions. I know there are follow-up questions that you have, but we are not going to have follow-up questions. Thank you for that, honorable members. You are really acting honorable. When you take a decision, you take a decision. I want to thank the South African Council of Churches for honoring our call and the researchers for state capacity research project and the outer, as even if they are not with us. You know, when we made this request, I was of the view that you'd say, but the information is out there. What are these people looking for? Because they can use the information for them. But this exercise, I think it has been very important and very good initiative for us all to understand the issues behind the documents that we have sent or the documents that are out there. I hope also the people who did not understand why are we calling these meetings and why do we want to have this inquiry, now they understand more. They want the inquest to carry on. And also, Bishop Mbumlwana, you spoke about these issues that we are confronted with as big issues that are beyond corruption. As much as they are seen as a petty corruption by other people, but they are beyond corruption. They are really, as you have put them in front of us, they are making our country to collapse. And if we leave them unattended, we will really get into a corrupt state and we will never be able to reverse it to become a normal state. And also, I think it is proper for us as South Africans to clean our own house. We can't expect a person from outside the world, outside South Africa, to come and clean South Africa. If it is us that are taking an initiative in saying we are claiming back our country, it is going to be a good initiative. And I think committee members, we have started in a correct footing because we started with God. We've put God in front of us. Therefore, we will be guided in whatever way we are taking as a committee. We will not go astray. Thank you very much, Bishop, and your team, and thank you very much to our State Capacity Research Project. We are not finished with our agenda, committee members. We are still going, we still have one item that is outstanding, and it's very important for our inquiry to engage with that item. If Bishop and the professor you want to be released. This is the time that we release you, but we're not going to forget you. We will keep in contact with you every now and again. We've got your contacts now. We have seen you, not on TV, but we've seen you in flesh. So we won't confuse you but with anyone else. We know you now. Thank you very much for coming to the meeting, and thank you for honoring our request. Agenda, which is update on preparations for the inquiry. We have a document in front of us that says map of it's a project map for Eskom. I don't want us to lend or to delay this. I want to get into it, and I so wish we can get into it in details. I will give over to the secretary to lead us on this, the secretary of the committee to lead us on this, and then members will engage as we go going through this piece of paper. I will now order monthly.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to say that the document is a product of the support team that was tasked on putting more flesh to the terms of references that were committed committee had adopted on the 21st of June. Subsequent to that, we have met, and then we have tried to put more highlight what are the key issues that the committee would need to would relate to what the committee has adopted. In terms of the objectives of the inquiry, we have tried to suggest the following to the committee in terms of what has already been adopted. That the objective is to investigate allegations of governance failures at Eskom, specifically to the early retirement and the reappointment of Mr. Brian Molefe, the failure to comply with procurement prescripts, which means it will include all the issues that relate to procurement, the appointment of board members and executive management, which is the process thereof, and the financial sustainability of Eskom. Those are the four pillars of the inquiry. And then there also we have identified the contracts that of Eskom that are under question. That have been identified. We have listed all of them on the terms of references. And then that does that in terms of the issue of the witness, we said that the committee might require a evidence leader with regards to this particular inquiry because of the complexity of the issues that happened. Now, on each of the pages that follows, we have identified, for example, on the early retirement of Mr. Brian Molefe, we have described the events that have taken place, the witnesses that will be required for that particular event, and then also what kind of evidence would the committee require in order to be able to do that real thing. So we have just tabulated all those issues for each of the issues that we have identified. Even the issue of the ESCOM's role in ensuring Tegeta was able to buy optimum coal. The issue of the awarding of the 11.7 billion worth of coal supply contracts at inflated prices to Tegeta. We have tabulated all those events, the role players, the witnesses that might be required, possible witnesses, and the evidence that will be required. Just this was just to ensure that by the time the committee have the, because we do have the two legal advisors that Parliament has dedicated to this particular process, who is Ms. Wayne Isaac and Ms. Fatima Ibrahim, who will be assisting the committee for this particular process. And then this is just to assist also the evidence leader and the legal advisor so that when they prepare for the inquiry.
Thank you very much. Also, honorable members, in my opening remark, I said we have seek Ilendo the attention, or we wanted Advocate Vanara to lead the evidence in our inquiry, but the Parliament has since returned to us. We've received an SMS or an email from Honorable Frolic that says Mr. Vanara will assist the legal advisors assigned to the committee. He cannot do it because he is the registrar of members' interests. Therefore, the Parliament will give us another presenter that they will identify, or maybe they will identify amongst the two ladies. But we emphasized in our letter that we need as much resources as possible. As members have said, that we don't want to go by the way with this process. It can't be a by the way process. We need all resources that Parliament can put in place to help us going forward with this, or we will be doing something that will not be effective at the end of the day, and our objectives will not be met if we lack resources. That's what is in front of us, members. You can engage. Honorable Singh, Honorable Luyenge, Honorable Swart, Honorable Shivambo, Honorable Meinir, and then Honorable Kongubele and Honorable Tedi.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think one of the more important things is to confirm the evidence leader. Because some of us who sat on the SABC, well, three of us here at least, sat there and know that Advocate Vanara was the evidence leader. And then generally, in an inquisition, the evidence leader starts the questioning. The evidence leader takes all the documentation that we receive. I don't know to what extent ESCOM have responded to or sent us information that we wanted. We have, you know, so it's the evidence leader that has to sift through all of that and then decipher who we need to call, when, how, and why. So I think it's important that we finalize that sooner rather than later. But then the other issue that I want to raise in terms of the project, Chairperson, is the question which I raised before of publicly advertising the fact that there is an inquisition in place, and it is sitting at the moment, and we should give the public an opportunity to send in any responses they want or anything, write about anything to us within a particular time frame, and we reserve the right to invite them for oral representations. Because we heard from the outer representative that it was whistleblowers that were coming through, and Parliament must not deny any other whistleblowers out there an opportunity to come forward as well. So there has to be, I believe, a public advertisement with a time frame that we need to look at. And then, Chair, lastly, the two other people that I thought, since we're talking about project, that we need to invite as part of those that we're invited. There's a gentleman called Chris Yelland. I heard him on Carte Blanche the other day. And there was the deputy editor of the Financial Mail. Both were giving their own interpretation of the financial sustainability of Eskom. And I think we need to use their evidence against what Eskom could say to actually figure out as a committee, is Eskom financially sustainable? So those are the two people that I would like to suggest. But having a chat here with Honorable Shivambu, I don't know if you want me to raise the point. He says, since we are in the groove, there's a song, I think, in the groove, should we not also consider looking into corrupt activities in Transnet and Denel? I'm asking the question. Thank you.
Okay, I understand that those are our entities. But if you listen to the presentation that we are given by the three organizations, these issues are overlapping each other, because a CEO of Transnet was taken to be a CEO of Eskom. So I think whatever evidence we need from every entity will come out in any way, even if we need to do the same inquiry into Transnet. I know there are huge issues that are happening in Transnet also, as much as there are huge issues in Eskom that we are focusing on now. But I think it is for us, maybe in the near future, to look at those issues. But now, definitely, information from Transnet, from Dinet, we will be able to engage with the witnesses that we are proposing to call. That will not be a difficult situation. It doesn't need a separate inquiry for now. We will get all the information that we need. I think if we can stick and focus to what we are looking for, immediately we get good results on what we have done, then we can shift our focus into something else or into something bigger than what we are looking at now. Thank you very much. Who's next after Honorable Swart?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, just on the Advocate for NARA, it's very important that we have someone that is an experienced litigator. In his case, he was an experienced attorney, and I'm sure advisors will be able to help us, but I'm a bit concerned with Mr. Froelich saying he'll be able to assist us. That seems to indicate that he will not be able to lead evidence. He was very effective with the SABC inquiry because he's got a lot of court experience. So we need to make sure that the person leading the evidence has got court experience, because there was a lot of bullying that some witnesses tried to bully him and he was very firm. And I'm sure that our legal advisors would be just as firm. But it's a question of experience as well as a legal practitioner. So if we're not assured that we've got the correct person to lead the evidence, we might need to appoint a private person or someone, if legal services, we would need to engage that, because that is a critical aspect. There's a lot of ways that you lead evidence in this. So that, to me, I would love it if there's a confirmation that Advocate for NARA will be able to lead the evidence, because it seems it's a bit oblique from their side. That's the first issue. Secondly, Chairperson, as far as the terms of reference are concerned, I'm happy, but there might well be the need where you might want to just add or any other related issues to that. So you cover yourself, because some witnesses will come and say, oh no, but that's not in your terms of reference. We had it in the SABC inquiry where some witnesses said, what you're trying to investigate isn't in your terms of reference, particularly if you go back in history a little bit. And so people, you want to have it or any other related issues. Now, I also understand that this is probably a tentative list of names, because if we get further investigation, I noticed that the Gupta's names aren't mentioned in this list, or maybe I just haven't seen them. Or Mr. Duduzana Zuma, his name is not. So the shareholders and the private companies of Oak Bay Investments, of Trillion, of all those, once I presume that once we've got further investigation, we might want to call those witnesses as well. And of course, the prominent role that was played by Minister Zwani, the minister, I notice his name is not there as well. So we would need your guidance there, because these are critical role players. We've got the evidence already, the information, and so we would need to have those witnesses as well. And then going forward, we might also want to call people such as our institutions, such as what we found with the SABC inquiry. We reached a certain stage where we came with recommendations, and then we had to refer it to law enforcement agencies to then follow on, such as the SIU and that type of thing. Now we might want to call the law enforcement agencies and say, well, what steps are you taking steps already on this information? We might want to, I'm not, or what is your investigation at the moment? Mr. Shivamba said that various complaints have been made. What is the prosecuting authority doing at the moment? That is a possibility. I'm just speculating. Because remember, the public protector state of capture report is a year ago already. Those factual findings still stand. They've not been reviewed by court. So those findings stand. One of the important points of that report was she then referred, Advocate Modern Seller, referred her findings to the NPA and the police a year ago for investigation. So those are some of the issues we might want to follow. And if we hear of, there's a lot of speculation about funds leaving the country. We need to hear from the banks, the Reserve Bank. How is it possible that these funds are leaving the country? So these are possibilities, I'm sure, that you've taken into consideration, that as we investigate this, further evidence might come out and we might need to call other people. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Swart. We are expecting that we will, as we go forward with the inquiry, people will have an interest to come and maybe give evidence or give submit something to the committee. There is a room for that. But we will see as we carry on. As we have said, these are our potential witnesses. Therefore, calling the Guptas and calling Mr. Duduzani Zuma, we will just it will be on an additional work that we think it is necessary for us to do, to call them and call the other people that have subcontracted in ESCOM. If it is necessary for us to do, we will just look at what we have in front of us and the information as it is flowing in within the inquiry. We will also look at the posture of the people that we have called from ESCOM. If they are really, are they still in the state of the 23rd of May, or they are now open to give us the information that we are looking at. So we will look at all those possibilities that you are coming with. Honorable Luyeng.
No, Chair, I think I'm covered with the inputs made by my colleagues here, and also your summary, to say even if it means we must go broader than we were expected, but obviously the issue of Amar Gupta's, we can't avoid. We must help them, and it must not be something that will transpire out of what we are going to do, as if it's a by the way. I think here we have a lot of issues that, as it relates to the reappointment of Mr. Brian Mwelife, then we want them on those bases. They've got something to do with Otegeta, and the common denominators are there. So I think, Chair, the way you are putting it, to say even this issue of Mr. Advocate Vanara, who will be part of the who won't be able to lead the evidence, but he will be participating. But let us make sure that we are not found wanting in terms of leading this process appropriately. We can make use of his experience, or maybe engage Mr. Varala with the honourable members that were in the previous inquiries, and look for further expertise, and also make use of Vanara to identify that. I'm sure that will assist us.
Thank you very much. And I think also, if the Parliament is not able to give us totally Mr. Advocate Vanara, with the legal people that are listening to us, and also are listening that we might source a person from outside Parliament, you will give us a legal opinion on that issue. We are members of Parliament. We think that is a right, that it's right for us to do. So you will just lead us to, and also look at the names that have been put in front of us now, and look the profile of those people that that are suggested here. Can I go to Honorable Shivambo?
No, thank you, Chair. I thought that the letter that you arrived there from the Chair of Chairs, Frolic, says that Advocate Vanara cannot be available because he is a registrar of members' interests and he's got other responsibilities that he is assigned to. So even if we were to wish to have him, the decline is already there that he is not available in terms of what Parliament has communicated now. So perhaps we should give a concrete and an unequivocal directive that we should find an evidence leader who is capable of conducting this particular inquest. And that person can be external. It can be an external person who must be recommended to then handle this. I think that is one thing that must be clear. And I want to come to the issue of the scope of the whole inquest and the whole inquiry. Is that I strongly believe that it should focus on Eskom, on Dinel and Transnet. And broadly, then we're going to be dealing with governance issues, with procurement and the financial stability of those three state-owned companies. I think that will be the most important way of handling it, because from the beginning, the terms of reference must be clear that we can call the leadership of Dinel, the chairperson of the board, and the CEO, we can call the chairperson and CEO of Transnet, and the super chairperson of a tender committee, which has got more powers than the board in Transnet, called Iqbal Sashama. He approves bigger deals than what the board can approve. So those things we can then be able, because these are the entities that belong to the portfolio committee on public enterprises. I thought that in the Chief of Forum, Honorable Singh, when we discussed was, when we admitted that we agreed on not going the ad hoc route in terms of this issue, we said that all the committees that are concerned must deal with issues that relate to them. If we take a piecemeal approach, Chair, it might take a very long time, because we'll finish ESCOM and then later on the Dinel issues come out in the clear. Let's attend Dinel, and then later on we must then do Transnet, and then later on maybe there will be another problem in Alexco, and then there will be a bigger problem. So let us deal with the three that are affected, and where there is clear evidence from the people who presented today that the three institutions are affected. Dinel, there is evidence that was presented by Outer that this is what is happening with Denmacha sending emails to Silege, to then Tony Gupta. So there is something that must be wanted to. Same with Transnet, that the same thing that Arnold Singh and Brian Molefe were doing in Transnet, they are doing now in Eskom. That must be responded into. And then we can then agree on the list of people who must then appear
before the committee, and I think that that list should include the president of the ANC, Mr. Jacob Zuma. It must include Malusi Gigaba. It must include Msebenzi Zwane. It must include Duduzane Zuma. It must include all those Guptas, Tony, Atul, Ajay, everything Gupta that is benefited from this process. They must come and appear in this process. But also we must call the NPA to come and account. I know that when there was a process of dealing with the illicit financial flows by the joint committees of Standing Committee on Finance and Trade and Industry, we called the NPA to seek us answers on why are you not acting on illicit flows of finances and everything else. So the NPA must be called to come and account to say there are cases that have been opened, why are you not acting? SAPS as well must come and give an update on what have they done with the issue of the cases that were opened with them. And Ben Ngubane, whether he's a chairperson or former chairperson of ESCOM, he must be subpoenaed. The same way SABC subpoenaed the chair of the board of SABC, even when he was refusing that time. Brian Molefe, whether he's there or not there, he must be subpoenaed to come and be held accountable so that we deal with these issues. And we must remember, Chair, that we're not just doing this for ourselves. It's not an immediate, just self-satisfaction thing. It's about solidifying a sustainable future of accountability and preventing this from happening in the future. Because if it continues in the trend that it has been happening thus far, we're headed for a crisis, we're headed for common ruin, which is going to destroy the country and destroy everyone's future in our country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me assure the members that we are going to call when we call the department coming to account on ESCOM, definitely the Transnet and the Denel issue will also come up. Therefore, the Denel, we are not going to leave them. I'm not saying as much as we are not going to stick to an inquiry straight to them, because we are focusing on ESCOM. I'm not saying we are not going to look at issues that are coming up on Transnet and on Denel on every entity that is under us. We will probe them, all of them. We are not going to shy away from our work. We will do our work effectively. But also the issue of the legal people, they will help us to look for a person who is who will be an evidence leader. They will help us in that role. Honorable Mayor,
thank you,
ready after him and Gungu.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. I've had a look at your ESCOM project map document. And just on the scope of the inquiry, I just want to draw your attention to the fact that the object of the inquiry is not quite aligned with the terms of reference. The last two bullet points, the appointment of board members and executive management and the financial sustainability of ESCOM do not appear to me to be captured in the terms of reference in your 1-6. So I would propose in the first instance that the terms of reference be amended to include specifically those last two bullet points. Then in addition, if you look, the object of the inquiry clearly sets out that it's the intention of the committee to look into failure to comply with procurement prescripts. But the one crucially set of procurement prescripts and procurements that you appear to omit from the terms of reference is the whole question of the controversial diesel contracts and the Denton reports. So it would seem to me then that I'd propose a second amendment that the terms of reference be extended to specifically include the controversial diesel contracts and the Denton reports. And I think finally, I certainly support the amendment proposed by my colleague Steve Swart, that there be a cat, let's call it a catch-all section which refers to any other matter. So those are three proposed amendments. Then the whole question of witnesses. Chair, it was my understanding that the committee had agreed that particularly Atul Gupta, Ajay Gupta and Duda Zana Zuma would in fact appear as witnesses. You now say something different. You say that they'd be called if necessary. Now, the evidence for the prior agreement is in a document which was circulated to the committee this morning in the Black File, where you say that Mr. Ajay Gupta and Mr. Duduzana Zuma would be potential witnesses and that they would appear, presumably potentially, on the 17th of August 2017. So what I would like is your assurance that Atul Gupta, Ajay Gupta, and Tony Gupta, which we've heard a lot about in the outer presentation, as well as Duda Zana Zuma, will be called, will be witnesses in this inquiry. I'd like clarity on that, and I would like the document amended to reflect that, so that there can be no doubt about this in the weeks to come. I'd like some clarity on that, Chair. It's simple, yes or no. No if necessary, perhaps, maybe. It's yes or no. They're crucial witnesses. They must be called. And the point made by my colleague, Floyd Chabombu, they must not be invited. They need to be summoned. So do we have your assurance, Chair?
Thank you, Honorable Mayneer. Honorable Mayneer, everybody that is on that document is a potential witness. And I think we have only one. We said we are going to call only one person as per the potential list. We agreed on, we did not agree on the whole family. We agreed on one person and Mr. and Duduzani Zuma, that they will be called, they will be part of the potential witnesses that we have there. Now that today we have this information that we have received here, the committee, not Uzukiswa Ranto, the committee will take that decision, not me. It can't be my decision. It has to be a decision of the committee. Thank you very much.
Chair, thank you for that clarity. Can I then, my understanding then is that thus far, as you've correctly said, the committee has agreed that Mr. Ajay Gupta and Mr. Duduzana Zuma will be called. Given the information that was disclosed to us today, can I also propose that this committee call Mr. Tony Gupta as well as Mr. Richard Seleke and Ashwan Chawla, that they also be included on the potential witness list. That is my proposal.
The proposal has been noted. Honorable Sedi.
Chair, I think I'm partly covered by my colleagues who spoke earlier, that when we met on the day we decided on the inquiry, we have adopted that list with the potential witnesses. I don't see us here attempting to change a decision that we took on that particular day. The amendment which says any other potential witness, I think I agree with it, and it addresses all the concerns as raised by the honourable members earlier on. The terms of reference are very clear that on the day in question, the committee decided to go the inquiry route on ESCOM. So obviously any other institution that relates to the work that we are doing around ESCOM, be it Transnet or whichever, will obviously be invited. That's how I understand this thing. But we must not be seen to be changing from a decision that we have taken on that particular day. The terms of reference before us are around ESCOM and any other institution that can relate, obviously taking into consideration the presentations that we received this morning. I think I don't see us differing. We are saying we stand by what we decided on that particular day, the terms of reference, the potential witnesses, and any other potential witness, even if that person is outside EPCO.
My immediately succeeding member, preceding member, is not making my life easy. You see, I think the problem, Chair, is that there is a positive initiative in a form of a matrix. I hope there's a positive initiative in a form of a matrix that these witnesses that are here are not just potential, they must be called. Now, the question that must be clarified. What criteria do you use to say these will be positively called or simply stay in the potential or to call? I think that is where the problem is, which I think we must clarify. Because I think we started nicely, but because of these discretions that have been exercised, now the question is strong. Because let me come and not make your work easy. Because that's not your work, it's the committee work. Because if you go to Tegeta, you go to Trillion Capital, you go to 43 million media contracts and so on, somebody from Gupta, if this falls under terms of reference, as I retain you, somebody from Gupta cannot just be potential or to call witness. But once you list this here, for instance, again, there's Chalwe, who has been receiving all these, running the Sahara on behalf of protocol of Gupta. If you talk about the appointment of Silike, who is a DG currently as we speak, with all the background and the role he played in the decisions taken around this contract, the male movement, these are in the terms of reference that I retained here. So the point that now, the question is that, I think the debate is why then do you decide who these are potential, these must be called directly. Because where I'm sitting, if you go to Duduzani, for instance, Duduzani is clearly articulated that he received the Silike CV to the president was actually came from him, right? And Silike is a material controversial factor here. And in that chain, you have Duduzani. And because the information that is in front of us, directly, they have to, both Duduzani and Silike have a, this is what I want to say. Both Duduzani and Silike had a direct role in the elements of these terms of reference. They had a direct role. The appointment of Silike, Duduzani is alleged on record to have actually submitted what you call Silike with all the background and even the being a conduit of what to call of emails. It is in this contract, the conclusion of this what to call of this contract where the China started. All I'm saying is that I think the problem is there. How was that decision taken? What criterion was used? If we can be clarified. So the point I'm saying is that I agree with the colleague who says, let's come to a clear, concrete view. Who is going to come to the witnesses that are directly called, not those that are going to be potentially called. Two, I also would want the guidance, Chair. If you go to Transnet and Dinan, I am tempted, if you remember, we got a letter from the Parliament that says we may also attend to capture issues. That letter is official. So in other words, I'm saying, That may lead even to a slight amendment of terms of reference, in my view, where you say, you're not saying you must investigate every capture issue. But you can say, for instance, DNEL and Transnet for capture for purposes for now. You may go to other institutions. But because the evidence against them is so blatant, right? Now, the point I'm saying is that you have got an opportunity to deal with ESCOM issues. There's capture element there in ESCOM issues. But DNEL and what you call, and Transnet, there's actually the bigger percentage of this capture. It's significant there. Let me explain why that to me the Transnet issue is also very worrisome. If you look at the possibility of economic opportunities that are caused by these locomotives being done in what you call in China, instead of, if I remember well, I'll need to be corrected, having expertise like countries like firms like Dobell and others, which have not been given empowerment to actually, where we have not created conditions for them to produce this, what to call. As I talk to you now, Dobell is closing, is in the process of closure, and Funder Bail has been getting no less than 16 million revenue per what to call, per month from that. So all I'm saying, without being lololo too much, is that the terms of reference do not justify why Duduzani, Gupta, Chare are simply in the potential protocol. They do not justify. My proposal is that a slight amendment of the terms of reference to say another thing is to look at the capture issue, especially to the extent that it includes in Zealand, Itinel, what to call, the Transnet. If we can find a way of cleaning up these issues. Lastly, on the evidence leader, I think I would propose a careful approach. I think let's not send a message that has not been researched, that the legal team that is here is not capable. I think we need to be given a record that demonstrates that they are not capable. Because we're worried about this, we don't want to assume that they are capable. But we also don't want to assume that they are not capable. So let's be careful of doing that, because you might find that you are leaving the best in your yard. You are going for someone who will give you a lesser job at a higher cost. But if, in our view, we think we need better expertise, the committee is entitled, in my view, to ensure that the parliament incurs cost to that effect. Now, I'm not making this job easy, because again, it then explains to us, if you take into account that these people have just been listed as far as I'm concerned, they have not yet been interviewed by whoever will be an evidence leader, so as to select the final what to call witnesses. And it appears to me that we can't see ourselves starting next week on the inquiry. All those things need to be clarified. There's a set of proposals that I'm making. But I am covered by Manir on the Gupta staff and so on.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member.
But the last point I failed to say, Chair, that the key thing to me that is required, everyone you call, like you have done, this is a brilliant thing that has been done here in this document, by the way. For every witness, the background has been explained, why that witness has been called. Even in these witnesses, we must be able to articulate the background because it does exist.
Honorable Singh.
Yeah, just you know, we're having a long debate about terms of reference and things like that. We who sit on this committee, and maybe the other members are not aware, when we met on the 21st of June, when we set up this inquiry, this was our resolution. I'm reading it from our minutes. The committee resolved that the inquiry would look into the circumstances surrounding the reappointment of Brian Malefi as GCO of Eskom, the process followed in determining the retirement package for the former GCO, and allegations of state capture affecting the Department of Public Enterprises and state-owned companies. The committee also agreed to amend the terms of references as and when there is a need. So it's within our power to do the things that we are being asked to do.
Thank you very much, Honorable Singh. I was going to say the terms of reference are open.
Yes.
We are to call anyone that we think we need to call. We are not going to confide ourselves to a certain group of people, because we might call people that we think are witnesses, and those people will not give us what we want. We will even call, if it goes beyond our expectations, the issue of calling the witnesses that we have now, if we need to call other witnesses, we will go, or even if they are not in the list, we will call them as this committee. So we must not confide ourselves on, we said in the committee, as we are going with this inquiry, forward with this inquiry, there are developments that will happen within the process of the inquiry. We will take note of those developments. And then if we need to amend the terms of reference, we will amend. We are open to amend those terms of reference with our legal team, with the help from our legal team, that we are not get caught of doing wrong things. I think we have done very well as a committee this week.
I don't think I'm clear. How are we resolved? I'm sorry to do this. I don't want to come back here and debate something that I thought I understood when I don't understand. Honorable Singh has articulated something which is a reflection of the minutes. But if you look at the terms of reference, that is not fully, what to call, captured here.
We thought we will deal with these issues on phases. But now that members of the committee see it befitting that we must include everything, then the terms of reference that we have in the committee, together with the terms of reference that we have here, we will change our plan. Thank you. Honorable Vambo and Honorable Tate.
Do you understand you tried to be saying that following up on the minutes of the previous meeting, we're going to include these other state-owned companies like that are under DPE, like that is Transnet and Dinel? No, I think that's fine. If that is the case, we're fine.
I think we'll agree that with Honorable Singh having reminded us about what we agreed upon, the terms of reference will have to be amended accordingly. I think that's what we're saying. I think we're agreeing.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor.
Chair, I was about to make exactly that point. The committee, of course, had a set of terms of reference, and the terms of reference captured here are significantly narrower than that. And so I would be very, very hesitant to agree or be seen to agree to this document. Do I understand that it's now your proposal, in the light of what the Honourable Singh has said and what the other members, including myself, have said, is that you are going to review and this document, and that a further document will be circulated to members of the committee? You'll bear in mind my proposals, Chairperson, to amend the terms of reference and the witnesses. Thank you.
My proposal is, no, we're trying to tighten issues, so we don't want to come back here again. You might end up calling us on Friday. Oh, yes. No, what I'm saying, on something that could have been resolved today. My understanding is that legal people, in terms of starting now to interview potential or to call witnesses, this is not going to wait for that. Whilst we're amending what to call the terms of reference. Because I don't want us to call for a meeting to again agree on that. That's the point I'm trying to make. So I thought that is important.
I think we all agree.
The last issue, on a lighter note, the colleagues on this other side, this my have said that, I have said that. It is becoming so prominent outside there. And I'm making a call that corruption issue, fraud issues, we must be as multi-partisan, as non-partisan as possible, so that the unity to achieve this goal is not sacrificed. Yeah, I'm strongly advising on that.
No, thanks. I think that maybe on a quick process issue is that perhaps the committee secretary and the content advisors should then draft the term of reference and then circulate amongst the members with a date that is due to say that by this time we'll have finalized them, and then we'll make written submissions to perfect them. Such that when we meet, we are all at one. We're just going to just stamp on them that these are the final terms of reference that are going to work on the basis of. So the circulation approach and then submissions will make. And if you don't make a submission, it's your loss. Like you have not made any submission. And the issue is that it must just capture the essence of the last minute that says that we must look into the other state-owned companies that they fall under DPE.
Just for a second, I think we are ready to be led. So we are seeing yourselves with the secretariat. Can you go back, amend the terms of reference accordingly, look at what is needed for us to start with the process? We are ready to be led. And as and when we are ready, you will then call us.
Thank you. Thank you very much, honorable members. No, we will see if it is necessary for us to meet next week. We will see if it is necessary, because we have already said we are going to be called at any time to a committee meeting. This, as the three organizations has... Can you sit down, Mr. Teddy? As the three organizations have presented to us, you can see there's a huge work that is confronting, that is in front of us. And we don't need to make any mistakes there. With the legal people, as you have said, Honorable Gungubele, that we are not undermining their capacity, but we need reinforcement, because we want as much legal people as possible that we can get. Going outside, that doesn't mean we are undermining their capacity. I don't want us to go out there and have the view that we undermine their capacity. Some of us know their capacity. We have been working with them, so we know their capacity. But as the committee wants to do an effective work, and the work that will remain with South Africa forever, we think we need more. We don't need only the two. We need more, because there's a huge work that needs to be done. Thank you very much, honorable members. The committee... No, don't put... The committee... We will now and again need your attention, and we'll now and again call you. We'll call Sani Cooper Ndawin and calling you. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
answer that I'm just saving.